it almost seemed like people were speaking different languages. What we've tried to do is kind of almost be bilingual and bring the two discussions together in a common perspective so they can integrate ESG from both a company and an investor's perspective.
Welcome to The Greener Way, the podcast that brings clarity, insight, and forward-thinking conversations on sustainability, responsible investing, and the future of finance. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar, Executive Director of Media at FS Sustainability. We are recording on Gadigal land, and we pay our respects to the traditional custodians of country and elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, we're joined by one of the most respected leaders in the ESG community, Dr. Ian Woods. For those of you listening who are new to the sustainability sector, Dr. Woods is a longtime pioneer in responsible investments, ESG, and climate change. He spent 19 years at a large Australian asset manager leading the integration of ESG into their investment processes and managing dedicated ESG equity funds. For the last 6 years, through Ian Woods Advisors, he has been providing advice to Australian and overseas asset managers and owners, as well as responsible investment industry associations. For those of you who have been listening to us since day one, you probably know him as the co-founder of the Investor Group on Climate Change, or IGCC, which has become the leading network on institutional investors in Australia and New Zealand. Now, adding to his many accomplishments is the release of his brand new book, ESG Unlocked: How Successful Companies and Investors Build Our Natural, Social, Human, and Financial Capital, which he co-wrote with Josh Dowes. Ian, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Finally, welcome to The Greener Way.
Great. Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Now, let's start at the beginning. We'll call it ESG Unlocked for short. How did the book come about, and what can readers expect to get from it?
Yeah, the book came about from a discussion Josh and I were having about the disconnect we felt existed between how companies think about ESG and how investors think about ESG, and then also how there's also some confusion within the investment community about ESG. And we thought, with our combined experiences, what we could do is try and join the dots such that companies can understand investors better, but also companies in terms of the way they think about ESG, but also that those who work in this space can better integrate what they're doing within their companies or with their investment managers or asset owners, the concepts of ESG, not only to create a better world, but also, you know, to create profits and investment returns, which is what investors are focusing on and what companies are focusing on. So trying to join the dots was sort of a key requirement. The other thing was to put it in a way which sort of demystified some of the jargon, like a lot of areas. There's lots of jargon in this space.
And definitely.
And acronyms. And so the idea was also to write it at a level which sort of cut through all of that and explain the sort of key concepts but keep the detail there as well, but without overloading people with jargon and acronyms.
So earlier I talked about your 19 years at a large asset manager, but in fact you're one of the pioneers in the climate change debate here in Australia. And now we're thinking about, is ESG even a jargon that will be sustained in the next 10 years, 20 years? What changed from when you started the conversation around climate change and now, and how is that incorporated in the book?
So I think one of the reasons why the whole discussion about ESG or whatever acronym you want to use in this space has become more to the fore is there's been some really key incidents which has really brought, as say, an environmental issue, a social issue, or a governance issue. From an environmental space, you think about the Exxon, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the US, and the consequences that had for the environment and socially and economically in the US and along that Gulf Coast, but also for the companies that were involved. Clearly, here was something that people had not sort of thought about, or investors had thought about, in terms of the way BP carried out its operations, and that showed that an ESG issue could be significant. Then you have other things like the GFC in the US and the issues around governance and structures. You had the Royal Commission into Banking here in Australia, where there's, again, issues around governance and culture. If you can gorge in WA with Rio Tinto. Yes. So there's a whole range of instances which sort of said, as investors need to be looking at how companies are managing these issues to understand risk but also opportunity. And from a climate change space, the Paris Agreement and the commitments made under the Paris Agreement by countries, again, brought the discussion on climate change that sort of not just one step, quite a few steps further forward in terms of companies really do need to, and countries really do need to think about what we're doing on climate change.
Can you give an example of a company that did it right in terms of how they worked with the investors? You've talked about all the high level, but let's say an Australian business and the journey that they went through to be more aligned and less disconnected with what investors want.
I think probably one, it's tricky to have this conversation because there's never one perfect company. And so you've always got to think about having a balanced view. But I think of one company that has been interesting in terms of its travels has been IAG, the insurance company. For a long time, they were raising the issues of climate change, which is not surprising, being an insurer, and the need to think about consequences of risk and returns and just the availability of insurance for many people. And you've sort of seen that develop and grow within the organization. Similarly, just understanding their role within the community as being an insurer, and how people can proactively manage their houses or whatever it may be to decrease the insurance risk or the risk of problems within the organisation. So I think they're probably a good example of how a company sort of demonstrated they understood that and had people who could communicate that. And there are other good examples within different companies as well.
And in your experience, what are the common misconceptions around ESG investing?
I think some of the misconceptions are that it's all just about excluding stocks. It's all about getting rid of the people who you don't like, and that somehow that will make a difference. Mm. I think that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions. It certainly, for managing. It's someone's superannuation fund and money. It's their money. They can decide how they want to would like to invest in it. If they don't want to invest in, cigarette companies or oil and gas companies, then clearly that's their prerogative to do that. I'm not saying they can't do that. But the question is whether that will actually help the issues with regard to climate change. And unless a lot of people do that and divest of a particular of a sector, whatever, the impact will be at best minimal. You just sell your shares. You're just selling your shares to someone else, and there won't be a significant impact. So I think that's probably one of the misconceptions about what the role of divestment can be. I think the other thing is that you just have this universal view of ESG as an investor, and if you really want to integrate ESG, you really need to focus on the materiality of specific issues to the company's strategy and risk management. If you really want to get value from the investor's perspective or from financial returns and risk, what those material issues are, trying to sort of have look at one issue and say, well, this is important for all companies in all sectors, is a I think, a misconception. You need, except perhaps in some areas of governance, which I think that is true, but on environmental social issues, that I think there are some misconceptions there. So there are a number of misconceptions. I think the other misconception is that somehow on the other side is that it will lead to lower performance. So the classic argument against ESG is somehow you're decreasing the investable universe and therefore your returns will be lower because your opportunity set is lower. There's a, I guess that's probably what you learn at first year university, but you then learn from that about how to manage the issue. The key question is not whether you've decreased the universe, it's whether the quality of the universe is better than what it was previously. And then as a result of that, what will your investment and risk returns be from investing in a different, in a smaller universe? Just about all active managers restrict their universe in one way or another. So, you know, some of those still obviously outperform the market. So the question isn't so much restricting the universe, it's is the universe better than just assuming a classic index kind of passive universe? So that's the other aspect which I think people sort of are misguided on when thinking about ESG.
You and Josh did a great job going through all those common misconceptions and the performance and the size of the universe. So I would recommend everyone, of course, to read the book. It's quite detailed, but it does come from an investor lens. So it's not just about the feel good factor of saying, hey, I'm all for sustainability. Now, you know, I'm going to ask this because you co-founded IGCC.
Yeah.
Is there a ticking clock? It seems like we keep moving the goalposts on the approach towards climate risk management. What are your views on that? And is that in the book as well?
Yes, for someone who's set up the IGCC, the book probably doesn't spend as much time on climate change as perhaps one might expect. But with regard to climate change, the clock is definitely ticking. I'm doing some work currently looking at the economic impacts of physical climate change on both companies and investors. I think clearly currently some of the assumptions both companies as investors are making are chronically underestimating the impact of physical risk. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that is, but the key thing is that they're underestimating the physical risk. And the consequence of that is, and because it's difficult, it's challenging. You know, we don't have a lot of the data, especially we might have the physical data or the physical understanding, but then what the transmission is to financial returns is a bit more challenging, especially if you want to start quantifying it. And people sort of focus on the transition risk because that's kind of easier to quantify, and investing in renewable energy or whatever it may be is something we're much better at understanding in terms of risk and return and impact on GDP, et cetera. But I think that focus on transition costs has, and the negative probably cost of transition on GDP, at least in the short term, has detracted from actually looking at what are the consequences if we don't act. And I think for me that is definitely a big ticking clock. And we don't have many years to do something about it because of just the inertia in the physical system. You know, we might reduce emissions next year globally, but the consequence of that for global temperature won't be seen until 2050 probably. That's because of the inertia in the physical system. And again, I think there's a misconception that somehow what we see as the physical impacts now reflects our emissions now, whereas what it really is, the physical impacts now reflect the emissions from 20, 30 years ago. There's a whole lot of impacts which are kind of already baked in due to historical emissions.
I must agree that it does feel like we're playing catch up to past errors. Yeah. So going back to the essence of the book, which is still across natural, social, human, and financial capital, do you think this would at least help the conversation with institutional investors and policy groups around perhaps being more aware of the ticking clock, whether it's climate change, whether it's biodiversity,
yep,
or across everything where a company leaves a footprint, good or bad?
Certainly that was one of the objectives. I think one of the challenges when talking about environmental social issues is putting it in a way which seems to be relevant to investors and or companies. And so that the conversations that you typically have in an investment committee or a leadership, executive leadership meeting in companies can actually think about these issues and understand how it fits in to the way they traditionally think about managing a company or managing in investments. And that was really what we were trying to do, is to help that discussion, to get everyone on a similar platform to be able to engage in these issues. Because I think one of the things I found, sort of observed in my time, is that it almost seemed like people were speaking different languages.
Mm.
And what we've tried to do is kind of almost be bilingual and bring the two discussions together in a common perspective so they can integrate ESG from both a company and an investor's perspective.
Finally, I do want to just throw in an author-related question.
Yeah.
But after the book's been published, there's always like that nerves you have as an author where you go, have I missed anything? Are there any facts that I got wrong? So how long did it take you to put the book together with Josh, and any kind of little gem or factoid for our listeners about the book?
Probably not surprisingly, started as a COVID project. So it's taken a little while to write for a whole bunch of reasons. Josh and I obviously have work we do otherwise. And then publishing a book is a sort of a trip in its own right. So that's how long it's taken us to do. And I think in terms of the thing that hopefully people will be struck by, and some of the people who have read it have the feedback we've got, is, as I say, it's really about trying to demystify this whole area. Mm. And that's really what the objective. And the feedback has been that we've managed to do that, which is encouraging, because you've been doing it, writing a book for 5 years. You kind of, Josh and I, have been in our own little bubble, and we keep trying to make sure that we've got to think about where other people are at and thinking about these issues. It isn't set too high a level. People will get missed the point. But the feedback is that we've managed to do that, as well as add right at the last part of the book, part D, we actually look at what you as individuals can do. Again, just joining the dots of companies, investors, and you as individual. So I think that's probably the other sort of key and interesting part of the book. And there's some interesting anecdotes as well. I mentioned some of them earlier on, but I think that also makes it quite alive. It's not an academic textbook. Not want to be negative about academics, but it's not as it's not quite as dry.
It's not as thick, actually. I can't stop a door with it. So it's something that you can read.
Exactly.
It's not a doorstopper. It has practical tools, very readable, lots of case studies. So I think, you've done an amazing job, says the person who's never written a book around ESG. But so I think we'll leave it there, but I will leave you with the $64,000 question. What's your vision on where we're headed? Where do you see the sustainability community a decade from now?
I would like to see the idea there being sort of specialist ESG people within companies or investors, that is no longer the case. That companies and investors integrating ESG is just part of business in the same way as every other part of business, accounting or strategy or management of risk is part of what a business does, and it's sort of everyone's responsibility. And similarly with investors, there aren't separate teams. it's such an integrated part and fundamental part of how you invest or how you run the company that you don't need, you know, a separate team to do that. I think that would be my vision, because then we'll know that the issues are being integrated into the day-to-day decision-making.
Having just interviewed an HR specializing in sustainable roles, it sounds like a tall order right now, but yeah. I'll book you in for another podcast in 2036 and see how we're tracking. Once again, Ian, thank you so much for joining us. And for our listeners, the book is available now. We'll include links in the show notes so you can explore it further. Once again, thank you so much for your time.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
This is The Greener Way. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar. Thank you for listening.
The Greener Way podcast is a product of FS Sustainability. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement, and if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.